You're listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on bingemedia.net. And now, movie homework.
Welcome to Movie Homework on bingemedia.net. I am Chad C., and I am joined, as always, by my buddy, Mr. Jack Falvey. How are you, man?
What's going on, man?
You know, another day in 2020. So
that's right.
We also brought on our good buddy who was on our last show of our new series here, Mr. Warren. What's up, buddy?
What's up, man? How's everything going?
I'm recovered from COVID, so, you know, you can't ask for anything more than that. All right, so we are continuing our series of underrated action movies, which we started with Jack's pick last time, which was The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, the original. Pretty fun show, right, guys? I would just say.
Oh, I love
it. Yeah. Even where we ended up at the end of that, I just love revisiting that movie. So.
Yeah, it's absolutely. That's like one of the. I think I gave it a 7, but it's definitely one that I'm going to revisit in the future, and I will probably, like I said, think at the end. It'll move up rankings for sure for me.
Cool.
So for this week, it was my pick, and I decided to go with the 1998 John Frankenheimer Ronin. I know, you know, given a little backstory, I think we talked last episode too about action movies as far as that goes. A lot of my love of action movies started with VHS tapes that my stepdad had, my dad had, and I would just fucking afternoon plow through 3 or 4 of them, and this was one of those VHS tapes, Ronin. I remember he had like Casino and Goodfellas, and then this one was the other De Niro movie he had that I would watch a lot. Nice. And I hadn't watched it in 15, 20 years since I've actually seen this. And I think this is kind of an underseen De Niro movie too. It's very under the radar. What about you guys? Jack, what's your history with this movie?
My history with this movie begins with, I think it was about a week and a half ago when I watched this for the first time. So, right. Yeah, this, I have actually owned 2 different DVD copies of this movie and just never watched it for no reason. It's no reason. Nope. So it was good to, finally get to this. I actually like John Frankenheimer a lot. I'm just checking his IMDb right here. So he's the fucking guy who they brought in to do Island of Dr. Moreau. And I gotta think that Ronin was like part of his, I don't know, benefits package for coming in and just like finishing that movie on time.
We may talk about that a little bit because he has a pretty bad run in the 90s there outside of this movie.
Yeah, he absolutely does. But his whole filmography for me it revolves around like 4 movies. Well, now that I'm looking at it, it could be 5. But for me, it's Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, The Train, and Seconds, which are all 4 like awesome movies. Seconds especially, that's actually the one I've seen the most recently. When the pandemic started, I actually watched that for the first time. Totally different movie than what I expected. It was like a Twilight Zone episode. But a lot of like radical, crazy shit in that movie. And I just remember watching that Island of Dr. Moreau documentary, Lost Souls. And the way that they talked about Frankenheimer coming in is like this really like, you know, sort of dictator on the set. It's just crazy to like see the dichotomy of his earlier stuff, especially Manchurian Candidate is so radical that like, I don't know, the perception of him was so much different when he was older. But I don't know. In any case, I like Frankenheimer a lot. There was no reason for me to avoid this movie for as long as I did. So.
Yeah. What about you, Warren? What's your history of this?
So this is one of my first DVDs ever. We didn't have a lot of money growing up. We moved right before I went to high school, and I got like a family friend went way over the top and got us like a brand new, so at least for the time, a Sony Triniton, which was like the flat screen, not flat panel, but like the flat screens with like, they were like 500 pounds, but it came with a surround sound and a DVD player. And he brought us sort of like 15 movies with it. And like, I remember going to like Tower Records with him, and he let me pick out like what 5 did I want kind of a thing. And he was like an action junkie. the guy that, that got the gift, but he also was very big on DVDs are like the new shit because you get awesome behind the scenes, extra footage, maybe different endings, and like director commentaries. And his whole thing was, it's really cool hearing, like, you know, someone that's been in the business for, even in 98, 40 years, give or take a couple years, to just talk about the process and just making films. So it's really cool to like get into this. I used to love this movie for like, this was always like, oh, car chases and cool action and shit. And two people that were in Bond movies, I fucking love those guys, like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about what I like about it now as we get through it. But yeah, this was, I'm not like new to this movie per se, but it wasn't like, oh, I was gonna see this when it came out. So I was like a little behind, but still watched it pretty early. So I've probably seen this, I don't know, what, like 15, 20 years ago at this point.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I remember about this movie so much was actually two things, the car chase scenes and then the bullet removing scene from De Niro. Like those were like the yep. two things that just stuck out about this movie for me. So this is a good little revisit. Watched it a few times throughout the past couple weeks in preparation. So, all right, well, we can just dive right in here. Obviously, like we said, it's directed by John Frankenheimer. All those movies Jack mentioned, Manchurian Candidate, as well as Grand Prix, Black Sunday, and he also directed The French Connection too.
Grand Prix is the one that Jack didn't mention that I probably would have, because that's yeah. like all car shit. So him doing car mm-hmm. stuff like made sense.
Yeah, and Black Sunday, that's one of his other movies that I've seen as well, with Shaw from our last movie that we did, and then Bruce Stern. It's pretty underrated. I think it's like 60. I don't even remember when that was. When was that? Was that was in the 70s, wasn't it?
It's 77, but it was filmed during one of the Super Bowls. I'm pretty sure. I'm almost positive.
Yep, the blimp. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Oh right. Yeah. That's right. That's when they let them like blow up the Super Bowl. Is that the joke?
Something? Like, yeah. Is that...
yeah.
Jesus.
All right. So this movie is written by J.D. Zeick and David Mamet, who yes. you obviously know from Glenn Ross, The Untouchables. But he's under a pseudonym in this movie as Richard Weiss. And we can get into this now because it's in the trivia. But so essentially, De Niro brought in Mamet once he was signed on to this movie to doctor the script. And so to write the snappy dialogue. I believe he also wrote the love interests as well in this. There was a big lawsuit between the studio and Zeick, and going back and forth with this, he was pretty much just saying that they brought Mamet in to run with his idea and he wasn't getting credit for it and yada, yada, yada. So it's very like tumultuous between that whole, the writing. But so yeah, we can get into it a little more with that dialogue that Mamet's so much famous for. Cinematographer is Robert Frias, and the score by Elias Smiril. Probably fucked that name up, but it's a hard one. This is like starring Smiril, yeah, sure.
Smiril. I go with Smiril. Fuck him, Smiril. Yeah.
Starring old Bobby De Niro, Jean Renault, who, going back to action movies in the 90s, Leon the Professional, that's probably my favorite action movie in the 90s. Right up there, at least.
Stellan Godzilla, bro. Come on now.
Same year he did Godzilla.
That's right.
I mean, that's definitely the first place I ever saw him. So,
mm-mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not me, man. Professional for days. God, I love that movie. I'm with you on that one, Chad.
Yeah, that would have been my pick if we would have done like not underrated action movies, because
yeah.
Yeah.
That movie's fucking great.
That's just a cheat. Yeah, that's just a cheat to get to talk about it.
The movie too is like, well, sidebar here, but the movie you talk about so much is Oldman in Reno. Renault is the star of the movie too.
Yeah, okay. Like,
so well known for that. But also rounding out the cast here, Natasha McElhone, probably fucked that up too. Sean Bean and Jonathan Pryce. So we got a pretty deep main core cast here. This was released on September 25th of 1998. Budget of $55 million and a worldwide gross of 70.7. I think I read somewhere that it made about like $41 million domestically. Mm-hmm. So not quite a big, huge moneymaker here. Mm-hmm. So let's just jump into the plot. This is a movie that's very simple, very, very simple structure. It's a 2-hour movie, but I mean, there's not a lot of exposition in this. But I got a very brief kind of summary of what's going on here. So at a bistro in Montmartre, Irish operative Deirdre meets with two Americans, Sam and Larry, and a Frenchman, Vincent. She takes them to a warehouse where the Englishman Spence and the German Gregor are all waiting. Conversations between the men show that they are all ex-government agents or ex-military turned mercenaries. Deirdre then briefs them on their mission to attack a heavily armed convoy and steal a large metallic briefcase. And I have this first clip here, and this first clip is a little long. It's about 2.5 minutes. But this gives you a basic idea. They're all feeling each other out. Good stuff between Sam, Robert De Niro's character, who's just really doesn't give a fuck. And he just really just like, yeah, just listen to the clip. Here we go.
What do you use? Weapons wise. Weapons. I'm a weapons man.
Weapons man?
Yeah. Okay. They tend to settle the argument.
So what do you favor?
Well, you know, it's a toolbox. I don't care. You put the tools in for the job, that's all.
What?
You know, I actually favor the old 1911.
45. Old gun.
Served my country well. Long time.
Your country? Not done too well, though, have you? Last few wars.
Perhaps not, but at least we don't go around whining about it.
You ex-military?
No, I got my job to the New York Times.
Tu laisses pas emmerder.
Non, mais non, mais.
J'ai des ce que je pense.
Are you ex-military?
The boys at Hereford.
I'm sorry, but I like to do it backwards. The line of retreat is...
She just told you. Meet back at the RV, disband.
I understand. I'm just trying to get a vague notion of the opposition. I mean, we're setting out the course of animosity over here. And who and how many are going to be coming after us?
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. Covers my body.
All your concerns will be addressed before we leave.
Electronics in coma.
Not more than 3 cars.
That is our information.
Can you get me a simulator?
It's a simulator.
Gunpowder sound, only no lead. Sounds like a pistol with an assault rifle.
Quite diverting.
Listen, I'm also going to need some bigger injection jets. Now, Bosch is not going to do it. It's custom made.
We're going north, we're going south.
And I'm going to need 2 nitrous tubes.
I know a guy who has these.
I'd like some new clothes.
Vincent will search it.
I'll take care of it.
So what brought you here?
Fellow that doesn't work so well.
The man in the wheelchair. How did he get there?
Seems to me that was in your neck of the woods, back in the late unpleasantness. Good reflexes.
Oh, yeah. They die hard.
So there you go. They're very much feeling each other out. The scene right there, Sam puts a coffee cup on the table and testing Gregor's reflexes and catches the coffee cup. They each have their jobs. And I didn't even mention Skip Suddeth, who's Larry, the kind of Porsche love of the group. He's the driver, though, and he does a lot of his own stunts.
Yeah,
cool. I recognized him right away. I couldn't place where from, but then I looked at his IMDb. I don't know if you guys remember, maybe it was the last season or the second to last season of Louis. There was like a 2 or 3 episode arc where Louis was a kid. And I can't even remember the plot line, but like he got some pot for the first time or like was stealing some for someone. I think Jeremy Renner was his brother in it. But that guy was the teacher, but I like recognized him. I don't know. I hadn't thought about those episodes for a while, but yeah, I don't know. Decent actor.
Yeah, I recognized him from Criminal Minds. I mean, way later, obviously.
Oh, okay.
He was kind of like a TV that guy, where you don't realize you recognize him. You certainly don't know his name, but then you realize what's up. And then it was awesome, like doing research for to learn, like Chad just said, it's awesome that he was like a driver. So a lot of the scenes, like he kind of stands out, where you're like, there's like these murderer's row of fucking amazing actors, and then the driver, and you're like, who the hell's this guy? But it makes so much sense as far as making a good, you know, a good action movie like he's going for here, or I guess espionage, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
All right. So the team's first task before the main mission is to acquire a set of weapons. And as soon as they get there, you can tell it's pretty fishy. Sean Bean Spence is completely out of his element, super nervous the whole time. And you can just tell this guy's not long for this job. This whole thing turns into a setup. They try to get him to come underneath the bridge at one point, and Sam's like, don't go in there, that's a terrible idea. And they instantly scope out a sniper, and then they escape. The team survives and gets the weapons, and then, like I said, they expose Spence really quick, and he's left to he's dismissed by Deirdre. And surprisingly, Sean Bean does not die in this movie. he's out in the first half hour, and then you don't see him again. He's just booted from the team, which was a nice surprise. I had forgotten about this. I didn't remember what happened to him revisiting this, and I thought he was going to obviously die, but he didn't. As the team prepares, Deirdre then meets with her handler, Seamus O'Rourke, played by Jonathan Pryce, who tells her that the Russian mafia is now bidding for the case and that the team must intervene before they get it. So I thought this was a good first little bridge in the action here for Act One. And honestly, I think for me, the strongest portion of this movie is Act One. I really like how the characters are feeling each other out. I really like the setup. Like, there's not really much. The first scene is, of course, they're going to the bistro, and then we're on the road and we're moving. What about you guys? Warren, what are your thoughts on this first act?
So, a couple things to bring up here. One, I love, I can almost comfortably say that this might be the last great, De Niro role. And I don't want to, knock down some of the stuff he's done later since this film. But as far as, he's on the poster. It's a De Niro film, even though it's sort of a wide cast. But he's, your selling point. So you talked about how they sort of disagree with Spence, right? Who's a raspberry jam, they like the whole thing. He's just such a nut. And I love the whole, he's talking about the ambush, and he erases it. Draw the diagram. Draw it again. Just draw the diagram. Draw what you saw. I love crazy De Niro. Clearly I'm smarter than everyone in the room, and it's not because I'm smarter. It's just I'm trying to make sure everybody gets out of here safely. And that's that dialogue. That Mamet stuff, I could see why there's a big fight with around that stuff, because going back, yeah, the dialogue is kind of what keeps me engaged with this movie. Before I would just, like I said, it was action car chases, but now I'm more invested in the in-between scenes and the planning scenes and things like that. And I love that stuff. And as far as the first act, yeah, I think it's great. I love it. So it's funny you picked this movie after we did Pelham, because this movie feels like it's from 1978.
100%.
This is not a late 90s movie. Just the way Sam, he sort of sets the gun down. It's all about prepping himself. He checks the bathroom. What are you doing? I never walk into a place I don't know how to get out of, that kind of stuff. It's all very slow and just more character building without doing anything. And that's not something that would, the next year The Matrix came out. You know what I mean? That's not an era of filmmaking anymore. And it was kind of refreshing, to be honest, especially with how great the dialogue was. But as far as first acts go, yeah, this is a great first act. I'm well invested in what's going on. I love the fact that they can call someone out and they just, you're off the team. We'll pay you, but and we won't forget, so don't be a dick since you're not part of the crew anymore. I love, it's just very oh, this is how business happens in France. When a couple Irishmen need you to do some work. But yeah, I love it. Jack, what do you got?
So two thoughts right off the hop. I think one of them might be more appropriate for the Act 3 stuff, but I'm going to say it here anyways. But first off, so the Sean Bean thing, right? So Sean Bean, I don't know. There's something odd going on with the style of this movie to me, because it feels like they're setting up Sean Bean to show up later.
Yep.
And it doesn't happen. And it's really strange. I think maybe that's a... what's the word here? Sean Bean's name carries a lot more weight now than it did in 1998, I'm sure, you know?
It's Chekhov's Sean Bean.
A little bit. But it almost feels like... I don't know. It just struck me that we get all the way to the end of the movie and it's like, oh, he's not. He just wasn't that relevant to anything that happened. That's odd. But I guess in 1998, it's not quite. Doesn't have the space. In culture.
I was waiting for De Niro to call him out as being FBI or British Secret Service, some shitty new guy that's trying to get in on some
right.
European, you know, espionage, and he's just clearly doesn't even know his own backstory.
You so
know what I mean? I thought that's what it was going to be, and it wasn't.
So, but here's the so I'm kind of talking this out because this is the first time I've seen this movie. So there, it's this has happened a few times in Hollywood. In fact, I think as recently as Iron Man 3, where you have foreign interests invest money into a film to appeal more to their demographic. So in Iron Man 3, there's a doctor in the movie, this Asian woman. Apparently, she has additional scenes in the Chinese cut of the movie. And that at the time, Marvel had taken money from a Chinese investor. This was before Disney purchased them. So there's a cut somewhere out there of Iron Man 3 with like 10 more minutes of this Asian doctor character in the movie. Ronin, to me, feels very much like one of those kinds of movies where, because, I mean, we don't have the perspective of this, but Jean Reno was a massive, massive star in France and internationally. Like, he's, his equivalent is kind of a Robert De Niro. I mean, he just never had, like, mass appeal over here, but, that movie Just Visiting, the original one, the French one, it's a comedy about these two medieval characters who get sent through time to like modern day, I think Paris. He was in the American remake, but I think he was also in the original. Like, he's a massive star. And to me, this movie felt like one of those sort of like internationally funded films where they tried to get actors from a couple of different countries so that they could anchor it into multiple markets. You know, like, it really feels like that by the end. And I don't know. It just, I know they set up a little bit with Jean Reno at the beginning of the movie, but I feel like there's a large chunk where he's not relevant. And then for the movie to end the way it does,
yeah,
it's interesting. So it kind of made me think that maybe the Sean Bean thing, I think there's another draft of this script where he is in the third act. And maybe I'm
sure.
Crazy, but it just, I don't know if this changed mid-production, but it kind of felt like, I don't know, two different branching paths. Like, the first act is the first act of the Sean Bean centric script, and the third act is the third act of like the Jean Reno script. But is that crazy? Like, do you guys pick up on that at all?
I can see it. Yeah. I mean, so, I don't think you're crazy.
I think the only thing I'll add, because I didn't really know much about Frankenheimer until sort of like researching like Reindeer Games, right? Like, you want to know about like the shit shows, like, what happened, right?
Yeah.
And I do think even in the, you know, the late 90s going into early 2000s, Frankenheimer still had, like, no one would say no if you were asked to be in a Frankenheimer film, just because, man, it could be, you know, an all-timer. Like, he's going to do something that doesn't happen in film anymore. And I feel like this, like, random six different countries, I think they just went to who's got chops but is also kind of hot now, and they all just said, yeah, like, it's Frankenheimer film. I'll do it. Like, it's a theory. But there's a reason why you get, like, we don't have to talk about Reindeer Games, but that is a loaded cast. And all of them just admitted, like, yeah, Frankenheimer is doing a movie and we got past the script. I didn't even read it. It's Frankenheimer. Why the hell would I say no? You know, like, they just hope that it's going to be one of those greats because he's the Manchurian Candidate guy, you know, like.
Right.
So I feel like, and Renaud, I mean, I think he was trying to branch out from his like sort of French piece. Like, that's why he did Godzilla in the same year as this. I think he was just starting to take big things any way he could, because even though it takes place in France, it's still Frankenheimer, you know. He's known for making American cinema blockbuster style move, like trying to, at least, especially in this decade. So I don't know, I see what you're saying. I just thought it was more like Fast Friends. We don't know. I think he was trying to lean into, you don't know who's supposed to be important, who's not supposed to be important. So that way everybody sort of has a little bit to add to the story, and whether they come back or stay important was so that you didn't know what was going to happen at the end. Was sort of, after watching it for 20 years, how I feel about it now.
I mean, it definitely works towards the movie's favor by the end of it, because I did feel, and I know this is some, this is some like third act stuff, but I don't know, it's kind of relevant now. Like I did feel like the movie was pretty unpredictable in a sense. Like, the fact that Sean Bean was kind of just like a carrot dangled out there. It's like, oh, maybe he's coming back, but he didn't. Like, I don't know. there's certainly like a lot of different branching paths to the way things go in this, and certainly with things that happen with other characters in the movie too. Just I don't know, it's a massive positive for me from the movie.
Great, it's great to hear.
Yeah, I mean, one thing you mentioned, Warren, the fact that as soon as I turned this on, I thought this was like, this is an 80s movie, this is a 70s movie, like this is not a 1998 movie. But yeah, I forgot to touch on that earlier, but I'm glad you did, because it is very much feels like a 70 or 80s movie. And speaking of reindeer games, Vin Diesel was supposed to be the star of that movie, and then he did not get along with Frankenheimer, and that's why he went and made Fast and Furious.
Fast and Furious, right? I think Frankenheimer technically started the Fast and Furious franchise, and Jack makes the joke about just putting whoever in the hell in your movies. Vin Diesel's the king of that. Like, he literally will just throw Donnie Yen in a movie just because people want to see Donnie Yen. Like, that's what he does, and I guess to his businessman's credit. But yeah, I definitely subscribe to that theory that Frankenheimer started the Furious franchise.
Pretty funny. Hey, cars bringing it all back. All right, so let's jump into Act Two. This is where we head to Nice. And first few scenes here are Sam. He makes the reference. I mean, there's a lot of these callbacks. He's like, he asks, what's in the case? He asks the case multiple times throughout this movie. He's like, is there a guy that's going to be chained to his wrist? And then, lo and behold, there's a guy with the case chained to his wrist. So him and Deirdre head to the hotel, and you get the great little scene of him having the tourist take his picture, and he's messing around there. And this is where their little love connection starts to begin to blossom. And then the next scene is that they head to the villa. And this is where they get extra steamy in the car, and they're staking out. And because of the 90s, right? You had to have this fucking love interest written into the movie. Yep. It doesn't really, it just feels weird, but whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that.
Yeah. So next big car chase, this is the first big one of the movie. This is where the team's going to ambush the convoy at La Turbie, and they are successful. It's a pretty good car chase scene. The technical aspects of this movie, I have no complaints with. I think the car chase stuff is very, very good, especially pre-CGI stuff. And I know that was a big marketing tool for them in this movie was, there's no CGI and this is all done by stunt drivers. And I think that the car scenes are pretty impressive.
They look incredible.
Right after this car chase scene ends, there's a big gunfight, and Gregor ends up stealing the case, throws another one in there, and he's painted it. And Sam instantly sees the paint on him, throws it out, and says, Gregor fucked us. Once Gregor has the case, he negotiates to sell it to the Russians, but his contact attempts to betray him in the car. And this is that scene where Gregor like goes to shoot a little girl at a playground just to prove a point. It's kind of fucking random. It's like, I don't even know her and I want to kill her now, or I tried to kill her and I don't even like you. So imagine. So he shoots that dude, and then he let's the Russian mafioso Mickey know that, hey, I know your dude tried to fuck me, and he negotiates a new meeting with him to give him this case. The team eventually tracks Gregor through one of Sam's old CIA contacts and corners him in the Arl Amphitheater during his meeting with two of Mickey's men. Gregor then flees, but is captured by Seamus. And this is also where Seamus, unfortunately, our boy Larry, gets his throat slit and is left for dead. Their whole crew of Gregor, Seamus, and Deirdre all escape. And during this attempt, Sam is shot while trying to save saves Vincent's life. And then Vincent takes him to a villa owned by his friend Jean-Pierre. And this is that bullet scene where, he's a good De Niro scene. He's like talking about scraping a fucking, what did he talk about, scraping with a grapefruit spoon or whatever, a wound.
Yeah.
And then we get a real big cheese ball scene, which is, it ties into the beginning of the movie, which I didn't even mention the first like text scrolling of what Ronins are. Yep. And so that's why this clip I wanted to put in, because I mean, it has something a little bit to do with the point of the movie, but it's also just super fucking 90s cheese ball. So yeah, here's that clip.
The 47 Ronin. Do you know it? 47 samurai whose master was betrayed and killed by another lord. They became Ronin, masterless samurai, disgraced by another man's treachery. For 3 years they plotted, pretending to be thieves, mercenaries, even madmen, that I didn't have time to do. And then one night they struck, slipping into the castle of their lord's betrayer, killing him.
Nice, like that, my kind of job.
There's something more. All 47 of them committed seppuku, ritual suicide, in the courtyard of the castle.
Well, that I don't like so much.
But you understand it.
What do you mean I understand it?
The warrior code, the delight in the battle, you understand that, yes? But also something more. You understand there is something outside yourself that has to be served. And when that need is gone, when belief has died, what are you? A man without a master.
Right now I'm a man without a paycheck.
The Ronin could have hired themselves to new masters. They could have fought for themselves. But they chose honor. They chose myth.
They chose wrong. Seppuku, what?
Yes, seppuku. Disembowelment. The sword goes in here.
So, yeah, another little goofy fucking scene. And then even in that end part, he's like, the sword goes in here, and he's like, ah! Like, it's just kind of random. But, hey, it says what the movie's all about. All right, fucking Ronin. Just Cold War operatives.
Fucking Ronin,
no
man.
Fucking mission.
I don't know if we need it all that.
It's fucking Ronin. What else do you need? It's fucking Ronin.
It's pretty funny. I had to put it in. There's no way I was not putting that clip in. So right after that clip, old Sam gets all stitched up and he's ready to go. And then we go back to Paris. Gregor is persuaded through violent interrogation to give the case back to Seamus and Deirdre. After retrieving from the post office, they are pursued by Sam and Vincent in another high-speed chase. This is the second big car chase of the movie. Where Vincent shoots out the tire, sending their car off an unfinished overpass, and Gregor escapes with the case while road workers rescue Deirdre and Seamus from the burning vehicle. That's the end of Act 2. And my first question is, knowing what we know at the end of this movie, that because up to this point, we don't know what Sam's motives are, and quite frankly, it's like, why are these guys still pursuing this case? Like, what the fuck? Like, I don't understand. There's these mercenaries. And he says he's jumping in the end, he's saying he's here for the case, or he's not here for the case, he's here for Seamus. Seamus is pretty easily attainable right there. He's fucked up after the car chase. And they're just like, nah. And so Seamus and Deirdre, I guess, just get away there. I mean, Gregor runs off, but why the fuck wouldn't he just go then and get Seamus, if that's what his mission was? Anybody?
on a first time watch, I think you're thinking way too much about this movie.
Sure, I know. I mean, I watched it multiple times, so sure.
I'm with you, but this actually reminded me of Mission Impossible 3 a lot. Because Mission Impossible 3 pulls the exact same trick. It's like, oh, you got to get the rabbit's foot. What's the rabbit's foot? Lawrence Fishburne literally says at the end, you know, I'll tell you about it next time. It's like, fuck you, man, you know. The whole, like, brief... Happens. Yeah, okay, so this is like where I'm at in the movie at this point. I like what's happening because you have a very solid group of actors, faces that we all recognize, who we've seen in great performances elsewhere. And they're just kind of having a good time. Like, I remember there was this Western that came out, I don't know, like 2008, 2006, somewhere in there, called Appaloosa, which I think was Ed Harris and I want to say Viggo Mortensen. It wasn't like a great movie at all. Yeah, okay, so maybe... All right, yeah. I mean, it's not like a world beater, but it's just like a solid Western. It kind of hits all the points you'd want it to hit. And I just got the sense after watching that movie that it's like, oh, these guys just wanted to make a Western and they took like a classic story and they just kind of did a riff on it. Part of me respects that with Ronin because the core of this movie means nothing. Like when they say turn off your brain action movies, I think this is what I'm going to think of first. Because the center of the mystery of like what they're trying to get, why they're getting it, it's just not relevant, you know?
Nope.
I think that once you understand that, any other choice in the movie is in service of just retaining that mystery to the next scene, you know? So, should they have grabbed Seamus there? Maybe in like a, I don't know, more complicated script, but it's just not in the cards for this movie. So,
yeah. I mean, the third act couldn't happen if they did. So, I mean, I get it. I'm just nitpicking here and there.
No, yeah.
I think
I'm being that guy.
My answer to that is I think that's part of the setting up the Deirdre piece where maybe he feels not everyone can get out of that situation safely if he focuses his attention on Seamus in that moment.
I mean,
but I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
He doesn't kill her, which ties back to that fucking Ronan conversation. He's learned, right? He's grown. He's not going to kill this fucking, he's in love, you know?
I wouldn't kick Natasha McElhone out of bed for eating crackers. So
yeah.
I get it. But that was pretty fast friends there. Like, pretty fast friends.
Yeah. So other than my nitpicking, Warren, what are your thoughts about Act Two there? I know you talked about it a little bit, but it's overall, as far as the card cases.
Outside of me not needing late 90s Robert De Niro to get intimate with anyone, I'm still happy with where we're going. These car chases, they really are like, I've seen the movie who knows how many times now at this point, but I still... It's like a 4-minute driving on the other side of the road, and it's not just one car. It's also De Niro following them, and it's all there. Like I still don't know. I understand how movies are made in a sense. I don't know how they did this without killing 100 people. Like, and outside of the hundreds of bystanders that get killed in this movie, which is fantastic.
Yeah,
but it's just the action is great. You really feel like you're there. And Jack had brought up like Mission Impossible 3. It seems like this is like the egg for a lot of other movies to tackle. Like you see this, the car chase stuff in the Bourne franchise, the concept of a legitimate MacGuffin without just, oh, I'm going to do what Quentin Tarantino does because it's, you know, kitschy or whatever. Like it's more of his style. No, it doesn't actually matter in a real plot, right? So, but as far as the characters, I love it. We definitely didn't talk about Stellan Skarsgård enough yet, Gregor. Like, he's really killing it in this movie. Like, I really appreciate it. And I wasn't happy that he became the bad guy because I always love he's got the 98 equivalent of a Bluetooth. He's got, like, six different computers running, like, 58K
always,
modem.
Always checking something, yeah.
But it was so cool to see that. And he's not always ahead, but he's definitely, like, integral to the plot, so I understand how the guy in the wheelchair, which is another like MacGuffin, they all know each other through this contact we never know anything about. And I love that stuff. And him kind of being the foil is great. Like, I just love that it is one of the team and it's not the angle that we sort of expected per se. Like, we have Irishman sort of doing like this backhanded deal, so we're waiting for that. We know there's some American guys because, again, you have Larry, and I'm not surprised Larry was the one that bit it, but man, he really established himself as a great part of this team through those couple of chases, and it is a bummer that he got killed. But before I pass it off to Jack, I still think like a sort of not talked about, like there's some comedy in this that's sort of not on purpose, but during the second chase, it is getting wild. There are multiple car accidents, like with Natasha, with Deirdre driving this car, and out of nowhere, like towards the end, she's finally doing something else, and you just slowly see Stellan Skarsgård like put on the seatbelt, like now we're finally like in the danger zone. Just little things like that I really appreciate about this movie, because outside of the romance bit, which I don't know, it still doesn't hold for me. Like, I just it doesn't seem like the proper, like, I thought maybe Natasha McElhone, like Deirdre was in over her head, and then she realized someone like a Sam could sort of be the one that's going to put her on the straight and narrow, or you know, just something else that I don't know about in the movie would maybe tie them together. But it just seems more like, I'm just a boy, you're just a girl, we're in a car, and you just fake kiss me, so let's turn it into something else. And I don't know, it doesn't hold. It's not enough to ruin like the journey we're on, and it doesn't really. I like the ending, And I'm sure you have some notes on the other endings that may tie at the end of this movie, but no, I'm enjoying the ride, no pun intended, but it is a badass first two acts. I'm loving where we are right now.
What about you, Jack, overall, after act two?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I feel like I haven't talked about enough is the action. And there are just a lot of really cool insert shots. Like Warren was saying, you know, just certain things that kind of reminded me of Heat in a way. Like, you know, yes. Obviously anytime that you have De Niro standing with an assault rifle, like shooting someone, I'm going to think of the Heat bank robbery scene. But there's just little things that I like, you know, actually in that action scene in particular. So when the man with the briefcase, when his convoy ends up at the light, Jean Reno hits the button, it goes red. De Niro gets out of the car and immediately fires a grenade launcher at the other car and then just opens fire.
And has a rocket launcher too. Like he just pulls out more. It's amazing. Yep.
So there's so a shot good, man. Of him sit like up out of the sunroof with the rocket launcher. And there are two shots. There's one facing him that you can see him holding the rocket launcher, kind of like shaking back and forth. And then the reverse shot is behind him with the rocket launcher out of the sunroof, chasing the other car. It looks awesome. I mean, it's all real, obviously. Like, you could see that you know, there are real people driving the cars. The scene you were talking about, Warren, where they're driving in the reverse direction of traffic, it's the dumbest little detail, but Natasha, her hair is like blowing out the window, or like when they take a hard turn, you can see the force of gravity acting upon, like, and you just notice it because she has long hair, so like it blows towards the window or whatever. The other characters are too, but it's just really cool the way those scenes are shot, because you get a sense of like, oh, those actors are in a real car and they're clearly moving at a speed that would make them move like that. Like, it just adds something to it, you know? Really, really cool.
You really feel like you're going 50, 60, 100 kilometers an hour. Like, you really do feel it. And I think that's all part of the cinematography, part of the action itself. Yeah. But I remember sitting there, like, I watched it, you know, obviously for research for this. And it just was, I was like, damn, these are good. And they feel real. Like, I don't know how they film this shit, because someone's in that car when it flips. Right. Like, there's a person in there. There's a stunt driver. That's not a dummy. There's someone in there. Mm-hmm. And the car is bent all over the place. I don't see any extra bars. I don't see anything. It's bananas. And it's just, it's really good shit, man. I love it. So heart pounding.
And I think one of the things that adds to the realism is the fact that they're all, real is not the right word, but none of them are sports cars. None of them are like souped up, unattainable vehicles. They're all cars that, like, very clearly these guys grifted off the street from like other people who were driving cars. You know, it's like, okay, one person's in a BMW, but it's like a mid-range $30,000 BMW. Yeah, it's not like an 80 grand sports car.
Yeah, it's like a 3 Series. Yeah, it's like a 3 Series.
There's nothing flashy about any of that stuff. And it works. In the car scenes, it works. In other places, I get a little bored visually with the movie because everything is gray. Everybody's wearing brown and black, and it's just like, oh, God. Like, when they go to that Coliseum, right? I don't know. I know it's Europe, but it's like the sun isn't out that day. Like, no, just...
Dude, I love that set piece, though. And I kind of respect the gray.
Sure.
Like, you're thinking France, so you're thinking, like, all these beautiful European architecture and all that. And really, it's just like, well, if you're trying to blend in, everything is going to have a lot of neutrals, a lot of grays, a lot of browns, you know, a lot of whatever the standard make. No one's driving a red car, you know what I mean? They're just going to pick whatever blends in the easiest. It plays to the strength of the movie, and I was expecting flashy, you know, where's the lady walking out with a baguette, like the stuff you're expecting is just not there. And I kind of, going back, I'm like, damn, there's so much shit that you want to like make fun of this movie, and it's just not there. They just pulled it all away because it's not real. That's movie shit. No. You know?
Yeah. I it makes sense. I don't know. I would have liked a little more of like a visual identity. Or, and I had this thought, and I don't know how you guys would feel about this. I almost would like to see this in black and white.
Because I feel big time.
Because I feel like it would just take away that whole like, why don't things look great here? But I don't know. Given what I've seen from Frankenheimer that's in black and white from the 60s, like, it probably would look amazing. But I don't know.
Yeah, this movie is another, like, this, being in France, like, I went there a few years ago and it just made me want to go back. Like, I think the movie does a good job of, like, showing the countries as, like, cool. Like, I don't know, just cool little areas. Like, and then the way they shoot it, too. Coliseum, mm-hmm. This little, in Arles, of all places. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think they do a really good job. All right, jumping into the final act here. Unsure of where to go next, Sam and Vincent decide to track down the Russians. One of Jean-Pierre's contacts tells them that they are involved with figure skater and Mickey's girlfriend, Natasha Kirillova, who is appearing at Le Zenith. And this is that another scene that's just, it's very convenient. They're like sitting in the diner at one point, and like these people are walking by with like, everybody's a figure skater, I guess. They're carrying all the fucking figure skating cases around.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those. Well, whatever, I'll let it slide. So then we head over to Le Zenith, the performance, and Gregor is there and he requests to meet with Mickey while Natasha is performing. He lets Mickey know that there's a sniper in the arena who will shoot Natasha if Mickey betrays him. And Mickey just doesn't give a fuck and shoots Gregor in the head. While seconds later, the sniper ends up killing Natasha on the ice. This sends everybody into a fury. Mickey then takes the case. Amid the ensuing chaos from the shooting, Sam and Vincent leave the arena just in time to see Seamus, who is in a security guard outfit, like tending to a little girl. And then he just so happens to see the case come by with Mickey and his henchmen, shoots them both and steals the case. Vincent pursues Seamus, but is wounded in a gunfight as Seamus shoots him. And then Sam ends up finding Deirdre waiting in the getaway car, and he convinces her to leave after explaining that he is still an active government agent working undercover to get Seamus, not the case. As she drives away, Seamus is forced to return to the arena as Sam is in pursuit. And you think that Seamus has Sam dead to rights, but all of a sudden, Vincent comes out of nowhere and he shoots him twice. Cool little like shot up scene of him in the rafters as Vincent takes him out. And then final scene here, Sam and Vincent have coffee in the bistro where they first met, and the radio broadcast announces that a peace agreement between Sinn Féin and the British government has been reached, partially as a result of Seamus' death. Sam keeps glancing at the door as patrons enter, but Vincent convinces Sam that Deirdre will not be coming back. They shake hands and part ways. Sam drives off with a CIA contact as Vincent pays the bill and leaves. And I have the final clip here, which is really just the last like 2 to 3 minutes of this movie. Yeah, there's a reason, but let's wait.
Have told CNN that it was the apprehension and slaying in France of the Irish terrorist Seamus O'Rourke by parties still unknown that contributed to stability, largely allowing the negotiations to proceed to their historic conclusion today. O'Rourke had earlier been denounced by the IRA, the military wing of Sinn Féin, as a rogue breakaway operative.
Well then, good knowing you.
I'm sorry.
You said something.
I said she would not be coming back here.
Yeah. She would not be coming back here, would she? I can't even put my hand in my pocket to pay the bill.
I'll get it.
I'll get the next one.
Wasn't the case.
I don't remember.
Listen, number two.
Keep in touch.
Thank you.
No questions, no answers. That's the business we're in. You accept it and move on. Maybe that's lesson number three.
Cue credits, and that is the end of Ronin. So I wanted to put that in there just because it was like super exposition dump, like explaining at the end, all right, this all tied in. Seamus is the reason, and peace treaty, yada, yada, this. And then you get the good little cut back and forth, but then the fucking super cheese voiceover by Renault that's not in any of the rest of the movie, just tying it all up. But I figured that was a good little scene just to throw in there at the end. All right, so that wraps up Act 3. Jack, where are you feeling? First time watch of Ronin.
So I've got two main thoughts. First thought is, I really like the technical aspects of this movie a lot. I can't say enough good about the car chase scenes. There's like a... Warren, I think you said that like this is a style of movie that really didn't get made after this. You know, like it was September of 98. So
yep.
The next year you have Fight Club, Matrix, American Beauty, Being John Malkovich. This kind of action movie, I don't know, it's kind of rare to get something close to this. So for that, there's a lot to like. At the same time, it really feels like it was an incomplete script like in different ways at different times. Like there are aspects of the movie that feel like they're going in one direction and then they swerve. You know, I talked about the Sean Bean thing. And it's interesting that like just from a nuts and bolts standpoint, the briefcase exists for the movie to exist. But if you took that briefcase away, there's just nothing. You know, I don't know how I feel about that. I'll be honest. I liked watching the movie, but I do feel like I could pick a lot of it apart. You know, MacGuffin was a thing that Hitchcock used a lot, right? And there are all different MacGuffins in different Hitchcock movies. Like Psycho's MacGuffin is the $10,000 or the $30,000. Rear Window, in a sense, like the binoculars are kind of a MacGuffin in that. The girl is the MacGuffin in Vertigo. Like but the thing about Hitchcock using MacGuffins was that they were used to tell, to like trick you into the real story, and then there was a real story to tell. I'm not sure there's anything to tell in Ronin, so it just feels like there's a MacGuffin to get you into the theater, and then there's no point. Like the title of the movie, Ronin. I mean, outside of the couple of references that they make to it, like, is there a great reason for it to be called Ronin other than it just sounded good? Like,
I mean, outside of them being, you can tell they're all like post Cold War operatives just wandering around looking for jobs. Outside of that, no, absolutely not.
Ex-mercs, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a little, I don't know, a little. It feels like a really well-made movie that didn't have one central strong driving force behind it. I think that's what I'm kind of like rubbing elbows with here. You know, I liked it. I just, something about it feels incomplete. I don't know if maybe you guys have more to say on that, but
yeah, go for it, Warren. What you got?
So yeah. So let me chime in here. So what I'll tell you is, from what I know, is that this movie was basically like one of the smoothest productions that Frankenheimer said. He said everything he wanted to do happened outside of the ending of the movie. Working everything through, it did. Like 13-year-old Warren was absolutely confused by the ending, right? There's a secret, like she's part of the Irish Republic Army who's working for like a terrorist cell that she doesn't know. And then Sam's a secret CIA. Like there's a lot of like double cross, you know, all that kind of stuff. But when you break it down to just that diner, and I got to say, I laugh every time of just what was in the case. I don't know. I can't remember. Like, that's so good. Like, that's just like taking a lampshade and just putting it right, like drawing attention to the case again, did not need to happen. The outro that you kind of put there, like sort of all that stuff. But I do like the motif of it's another way that Vincent and Sam sort of bond. Like that's sort of what we got out of this. Was Sam was probably going to, he's trying to find someone that he's not just self-reliant on his own. Maybe this is his last job, whatever, but they don't pay attention to that because that's not what the movie's about. But they sort of set up that what the first rule is, if there's ever any doubt, there is no doubt. That's the first rule. The second rule is, who taught you that? The second rule is, I forgot. That's the second rule. You don't tell anybody. And then they bring back that Vince really was paying attention to that. He really wanted to know more about it. And I did like the fact that I liked De Niro, like Sam's character, sort of wanting Deirdre to be like, come back. I did like that. It was just a little bit like he's checking the door and it's just like, that's not going to happen. And Chad, do you have notes on the one of the endings?
Yeah, we can talk about it.
I just didn't want to step on of your notes, but includes Deirdre. One of them includes Deirdre, or both of them.
Let's talk. It's the first part of it. So the original ending featured Deirdre arriving outside of the cafe, deciding not to go in, and then being snatched by the IRA. Test audiences all hated the ending, and that's the one that Frankenheimer prefers, though.
It's a better ending.
I agree.
I think it's a way better ending.
Yep. Is that the one you're talking about? Or
that's the one I'm talking about. I think that fits what he wanted to do better, but he's a company man. You know, the Universal wanted to do, they gave me a lot of money, so I get all that. That being said, it was the late 90s. Figure skating was massive. Like, so of course it was going to be in there, right? And I love that it was just like realism. Katarina Witt was like a real gold medalist. It was really cool to see an actual figure skater doing her shit to the point where it was just something that's actually happening in the background. Did we need it? Probably not, but it made for good. Like, if I was, Mickey, I believe he went by, like, if that's his lady and they're using that as like, that's his prized possession, but obviously it wasn't. Like, just there's so many little things that made sense along the way for character pieces. And Michael Lonsdale, which was Jean-Pierre, I know we talked about him in the second act, but I really liked his performance. It seemed a little tacked on towards the end because he's either like the most interesting veterinarian you've ever met or the fucking most boring veterinarian you've ever met, right? So like, I really forgot how much it was just characters just learning and growing from scene to scene to scene. And then in between is just breakneck, like badass action in between. But by the time the movie ended and I actually was able to follow, just because I was either just paying proper attention, taking notes, and just knowing all the beats, I kind of liked that by the time I got to the diner and it just went right back to sort of where they started, but only two were left kind of a thing. Like, I don't know. It made sense to me. And I really liked the journey I was on. And for some reason, like I said, I guess in the last like 20 years, I kind of forgot that there's really good dialogue in this movie. And it just really, like, I caught myself just like chuckling at like non-moments that I probably wouldn't have noticed when I was 15, 16 years old watching this. I was pretty happy with how it ended. It's certainly the weakest of the three acts when you really start to extrapolate. Mm-hmm. And sometimes like there's like one extra twist too many, I feel like. Like there's just like so many double crosses and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I love that scene of when you have Gregor and Mickey in the room and you have 30 seconds or, she will be killed, and you just see him pull the gun out. You have 25 seconds and the tension's there and he just shoots him right in the head, like mm-hmm. doesn't care. And then she gets shot and it's like a whole thing. That's great. Like, that's great storytelling at that point. Like, these are just ruthless ass people that just want to get the thing. And then it turns out, I feel bad that we're not talking about Jonathan Pryce's Seamus O'Rourke a lot, but he does kind of feel like the weak link in this. I don't know if I needed that Irish terrorist angle.
Yeah, I don't know if he feels natural. Like, I think he feels like Jonathan Pryce is an amazing actor, but he just feels in his, I don't know if I've ever actually seen him in too many action movies, honestly. I don't know if this is his forte, though. He just, like, even there was that one scene of him, like, when he's holding the gun out the window and he's like holding it, it just looks awkward.
He only looked good with the throat slit. Like, that I believed, and I trusted him as like a just sitting in, houses with no electricity, just hiding out, like can't really get out in the public because he's trying to pull mm-hmm. the shit. But I don't know, just something about a Welshman trying to do an Irish accent, and I already know, I don't know, it just seemed very, he was like trying a lot, and I hate to like knock Jonathan Pryce because he has done some incredible work, but I don't know, just some of that piece just really drew adult Warren out a bit, a lot, in a sense. Yeah. It didn't break the movie, but it's just like, man, if there's like little bits, like if you just like maybe shaved 7 minutes or something like that. But I think the other ending that you talked about, I think it just would have been like, oh, okay, so it's about the thing that doesn't matter, and then Sam growing as a whatever, an agent that maybe is, you know, I'm just going to go back to my job, but now I got some friends that I can build connects in France now. Like something like that would have been cool. Like if there was a Ronin 2, you know, I don't need that. But if there was, at least he, now we got a guy in France, you know, we got a guy in England. You know, he can just like have a network. And that I liked if that was the case. But unfortunately, that's not really what they do.
I could see the sequel with just Sam and Vincent, you know, those two getting back together. I mean, it's never going to happen, but I could see it. All right. So that really kind of sums it up. We'll get into our normal themes, compliments, complaints. Obviously, themes, loyalty is a big one in this. The team's relentless pursuit to finish the job, even when things continue to go haywire. Obviously, we talked about that. Double-crossing cocksuckers, man. Big theme of this movie. They're
all this. Yeah.
Everybody. No matter what, you're like, all right, they're going to. No, he's still going to do this. A lot of compliments I saw, obviously, we've discussed. The real car chase is done by the stunt drivers. Absolutely no CGI was used in this movie. Performances by De Niro and the supporting cast overall, I think, is pretty strong. That's what, one thing I did notice. I didn't really notice any of the, I didn't think any of the actors were like bad, really, per se. I mean, like we said, Price maybe just a little out of his element in action movie, but I mean, I didn't really have any complaints. Even Natasha McElhone, I thought, was fine. And then Smeeril's score, of course, it's got a little bit of a haunting bit to it, and that I've seen that a lot of people like that. Complaints, Jack brought it up, of course, it's impossible to not bring it up. The use of the briefcase is a MacGuffin, and like Jack said, there's really not a point of the movie without the case. And we never learn what's in the case. What do you guys think's in the case? What's in the case? I think it's Mark Paltrow's head. I think it's Marcel.
Yeah, Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
And then, of course, complained of the unnecessary romantic storyline. Could have done without it. Who couldn't have? But it's the 90s. You got to write that in.
Of all that stuff, the only thing I want to say is, for me, this is just me personally, the score, I actually hated the score. I don't know if you guys had an opinion on it one way or another.
Nah, I thought it was pretty forgettable. Yeah.
There, so what I try to do, sorry to hop on you, Jack. I was surprised because, at least with me, I'm usually the guy that'll bring up the score almost instantly, for better or worse. This is one of those cases where my expectation was not hit. Like, 90s was, there's some real, like, it could have had, like, GoldenEye synthy, like, European, like, it could have really made some choices that it didn't need to. And since it's sort of forgettable, I always chalk that up to, okay, if I don't notice the score, that's a good thing. Doesn't necessarily make it great, but it means it's not a problem. I'm surprised it got praise, but again, it just makes me feel like I'm watching a late 70s movie. That's all it really did, is it did its own job of taking me out of 1998, even though, you know, modern cars at the time and things like that.
See, now,
but yeah, good.
I had the opposite reaction. So the scene at the beginning where they go to underneath the bridge and they're going to do the weapons deal, right? During that scene, when Sean Bean's character starts walking towards under the bridge, all of a sudden it cuts back to De Niro, and he's kind of like thinking about what his next move is going to be, and then eventually the driver comes up and starts, like, you know, he opens up the trunk and all this other stuff. As this whole like moment is happening, the score in the background is like this like percussive stuff, and it's just like, I was like, what fucking movie is this? Like, so for me, Warren, on the flip side, is like, if I notice the score and I have to think about it, marks against. So for me, I really, really did not like the music in this, but that's just me.
I will say that percussion that you're talking about was fucking killer in the action scenes, though.
Yeah,
the scene you're bringing up, I would say, honestly, if I had like a real complaint that isn't just the relationship, because that's such a non-moment, that opening sort of heist, you know, the arms deal that goes bad, that's probably the weakest bit in the movie for me. It's still in the best part of the movie, But that whole thing, like, I still drawing attention to Spence. He's like, Sean Bean's doing like 11 and a half out of 10 with his performance, just trying to not be not like late 90s Sean Bean already. He's not calm and collected. He's sweating. He's shaking. He's talking a lot. He's like doing Cockney rhyming slang that I don't really hear from him very often anyway. So like that, yeah, I already feel like that's just part of it. It's just like, it's just to make you, you're supposed to notice it. You're supposed to be uncomfortable because this is wrong, basically. It's just how I felt. But luckily it mulled out for the rest of the movie. So I was like, okay, so that was maybe the point. You know, I kind of gave the filmmaker a little cred.
The only other thing that I wanted to mention too is that I think I'm at a slight disadvantage with this movie because to me it's very clear that Christopher McQuarrie is a huge fan of Ronin because he's used, I swear, there are shots in the car chase scenes that I remember seeing in like Mission Impossible 4 and 5. You know, I know he didn't direct 4 or 3, but obviously the MacGuffin thing is like clearly the exact same thing that they do in Ronin. Mission Impossible 3 lifts that right there. This scene we're talking about right now happens at the beginning of Mission Impossible Fallout. It's the exact same thing. It's a setup. Like, I don't know. It just, I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because I've kind of, I hate to say it, but like I've seen somebody do it better more recently. And like, I'm seeing it in Ronin. I'm kind of like, oh, okay, I know how this goes. And like, I don't know. It doesn't hold up as well on a first time watch.
Because I know you as usually a credit to the original kind of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just feel like, imagine being in the late 90s and expecting movies in the 90s and you don't get that. I think it makes it sort of all-timey in a way. Like, I'm really happy Chad picked this one because it really does. Even though you don't realize, like, you watch Heat and you watch this, no one's going to think that Ronin came out after Heat ever. Like, it's just not that type of movie. And I feel like it's to its benefit because as it gets older and older and older, it's like one of the last ones that doesn't have cell phones and, you know, internet and all this stuff. It's got old tech, but like it's just old enough that it's not smart tables and a bunch of bullshit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, just doing research, this movie is regarded easily as one of the best car like movies ever, like up there with Bullet, French Connection, Italian Job, absolutely. You know, Gone 60 Seconds. But I mean, yeah, I mean, so that alone, I mean, I think it's worth, you know, checking out for people that haven't seen this. All right. Let's see here. Get into the trivia. We already talked about one of the endings that was that never happened. The talk about the man in the wheelchair is referencing the book The Bourne Identity by Robert Ludlum. The man in the wheelchair was M. Chernak, a mercenary broker who Jason Bourne killed. A total of 80 automobiles were destroyed during filming. Interesting.
That's amazing.
As we talked about, Skip Seth requested to do his own stunt driving during the car chases, and John Frankenheimer agreed, and he told him, "I don't want to see any brake lights."
Yep.
300 stunt drivers were employed to give the final chase scene the required amount of metal crunching realism, which, I mean, you talk about how this movie would never get made again today. The fact that they employed 300 stunt drivers, that's something that would absolutely never, ever in a million years happen in 2020.
That's CGI artists, yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. As I talked about, David Mamet, I'll just get into like full details here. David Mamet worked on the film as the script doctor. He rewrote a significant amount of the script, making major changes to character and dialogue from J.D. Zeick's original. There is a dispute among the studio director, John Frankenheimer, and the WGA over the credit, with MGM and the WGA insisting that Zeick be given story credit and billing over Mamet. They wouldn't back down, and so Mamet asked that his name either be removed or placed under a pseudonym. The credits of the film now read, story by J.D. Zeick, screenplay by J.D. Zeick and Richard Weiss. And then three of the actors in this movie have played the antagonist in three separate Bond movies: Sean Bean in GoldenEye, Michael Lonsdale in Moonraker, and Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies. And these three actors do not appear together in any scenes in this film. So,
that's awesome. I never put that together. That's great. Oh, that's right. He's Drax. Forgot about that.
He just died too. Died maybe 2 months ago.
Right? Yeah, like a couple months back.
All right, so that sums up Ronin. I almost said 47 Ronin, which I've never fucking seen. But I know how it ends now. What the fuck, Ronin? No.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I'm going to go first, and then I'll throw it to you guys with my ratings here. So, like I said at the beginning of this, revisiting this was a pretty fun time for me. All of its shortcomings, we could pick the fucking... apart, all the stuff added, the unnecessary voiceover at the end, the cheesy bit at the beginning. But I think that adds to this movie's charm a little bit for me. And this is going to get a few more extra points just nostalgia alone for me. So you can take that with a grain of salt. I had a good time with this. I'm not going to pound the table and say this is fucking incredible and you have to see it. But if you're a fan of heist movies, you're a fan of car chase scenes and stuff like that, you could do a lot worse than Ronin. This is going to be a 7 on 10 for me. Warren, what about you?
So I'll echo a lot of the stuff you were saying. I definitely love the action is something where I really feel like it's the last time we're going to see that kind of action. Even when we get as soon as the Bourne movies, that's where I don't want to call it shaky cam, but you know what I mean? Like that whole Paul Greengrass style of it's great for that movie. And everybody tries to do that because it's gritty or whatever. But this just does classic cinematography, classic movie making with, like I said before, I forgot about it, like just great dialogue. And I think that in itself, like I said, I could pick apart, I could nitpick some parts of the movie and you know, find ways to really break it down. But at 2 hours, it doesn't overstay its welcome, which is huge for me because I was like, damn, I don't remember this being this long. But then when you realize that like 15 minutes of it is dedicated to just car chases, it sort of isn't such a big deal. There are a bunch of twists and turns that I guess it could be one step too many, but this is definitely like one of the top 90s action movies and then probably one of my top action movies. You know, maybe lower on the list, but it still deserves its spot. So I will avoid halves since I'm on record with Mr. Falvey. I am going to give this an 8 out of 10.
Nice. All right, Jack. No pressure.
No pressure at all. So I... it's difficult to know how to feel about this. There's a lot that I really liked. We talked about it. I mean, the action scenes are great. I love the cast. There's nobody bad in the cast. You said it, I think, Chad. Nobody's bad in this movie. You know, the three Bond villains, that's pretty cool. I recognized Michael Lonsdale. I couldn't remember his name, but I didn't put that together at all until you said it. That's cool. This feels a lot like Bond movies of that era to me. Like the way that it's shot and the feel of it is very similar. In a way, it kind of almost feels like De Niro's dropped into a Bond film, you know, like in some ways. But there's a lot of stuff that I didn't love. I didn't really jive too much with, I don't know. At the end of the day, I kind of feel like I was had a little bit, you know, like there's no, I don't know. I'm trying to think of how I feel. It's difficult because I really don't like the MacGuffin thing at all in this case.
Really?
I really
thought you were gonna love that, Jack.
See, now there are things that
I
like.
Yeah, I was opposite. I knew Jack was gonna have a problem with that.
I thought he was gonna love it.
I there are movies where I like it, you know, but in this it's like it's just so transparent that I
I mean I don't disagree with Jack either though, like I don't, I guess that I think the nostalgia brings it up for me, but I mean I'm 100% with Jack as far as that goes, because without it there is no fucking movie and whatever. Sure. What are we doing, just driving cars around? Sure. But I feel you, Jack.
I just don't know how much of a problem it is for me, like I didn't love the love story. I did feel that it was a little bit too long.
100% too. Yeah, you could have shaved that whole last 20 minutes off the movie, honestly. I think like the whole ice skating thing, and I think that was Frankenheimer too. He was saying that he was a huge fan of ice skating, and so he wanted her to be in the movie.
You don't want to put Katarina Witt in that movie. She looks great.
Well, originally too, I think
so good at it.
I think I read that he, like, there was a lot of obviously stuff with the script and they had to push the filming and she wasn't gonna be able to be in it and it was gonna be cut, but then once she was able to do it, that's when they wrote that stuff back in. So I mean, I could take it or leave that whole little bit, but sorry for interrupting you, Jack.
No, not at all, man. You know what I think it is? I think it's that my emotion around this movie is tied very closely with Sean Bean, and here's why. Okay. Rest in peace, Boromir. That's all you have to say. R.I.P. Boromir. So I just feel like if Boromir, you know, is in a movie, even if he's not called Boromir, I don't know, you should use Boromir because he's probably better than most of the actors that are in the movie. And the fact that they kind of just like have him and then he kind of takes off, it's like, well, and you know, I was, as we were talking, I was looking up some stuff on IMDb just to get my timelines right. So GoldenEye is 95, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's already a Bond villain at this point.
Right. Sean Bean is very well known in the UK for this series called Sharps. Sharps Army, yes. Or Sharps whatever. It's like a made for TV series of these like sort of like romance novel history stories. Real fucking strange. This guy's established at this point. I mean, there's a reason that the next year he gets cast in Fellowship, right? I don't know. I feel like Sean Bean was kind of squandered, and feels like a missed opportunity. The fact that Jonathan Pryce becomes the main villain at the end, and he's just not good for that role. It's like, dude, had Boromir. Like, just use Boromir.
But he has less scenes than Sean Bean has, and Sean Bean owns what he has. Like, I accept the story and just casting an awesome actor to do that and to play out of his element, because he was suave, sophisticated, at least to American audiences. They saw him as not only a villain, but he was a 00 agent in that.
Right.
He was he was 006 turned villain, to then just make him this, maybe he had, you know, a bad high, doesn't sleep, puking, can't handle car chases, just, I don't know, like, he's going above the 10 mark. Like, he really does go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I feel like he kind of stole his parts in a good way. And that just made for such like a, dude, Sean Bean's out of the movie? Holy shit. Mm. Like, I thought it made for an interesting piece. And only because I feel like the other cast did so well. Like, if it was like the best actor was removed, then I could see what you mean. But I feel like he was just on par with everybody else. Outside of Jonathan Pryce. He's definitely the one I have a problem with.
What if Sean Bean Spence is the sniper? Him and Gregor are the team. Is that a better move for you, Jack? He's the sniper.
That's what I was expecting. I was when they said there's a sniper on the roof. I'm like, oh, dude, Boromir's back.
There's a cut of that movie. There's a cut of that, right? They wanted to film that because they hood the sniper.
Yeah.
It had to have been him, right? But he didn't look like he actually knew how to use guns.
Well, he says it.
Like, I didn't believe.
He's supposed to be the weapons guy, but doesn't Gregor? Doesn't he say, I have one of my associates is here and she never misses or something?
The sniper is a she. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I could see in that movie for sure. You know, fucking Spence comes back, get revenge, him and Gregor team up.
Right.
That's a good call, though. That would be, it makes the world feel a little smaller, but I still like it. That'd be a really cool angle, you know.
So Warren, you used a phrase that I'm going to use in my rating. You said you accepted the story. I think that's the center of my problem. I don't accept the story. I think that's it. But that being said, I do think I'll rewatch this again because the action was so good, and if I'm grading this on a bell curve of, is this a good action movie? It definitely is. It definitely is. It's probably nitpicking, but after all of that, I'm with Chad. I think I would give this a 7. I think I like more of it than I dislike. So.
I know it's talked about a lot on this network, but this is very much a dad movie. Very much.
100%.
I know my dad. Yeah, my dad loves it. My stepdad loves it. I mean, it's you know, those fucking action movies that I grew up watching, and they are obsessed with it. I don't give a fuck. The people that watch this movie aren't going to this movie for, and that's one thing obviously I struggle with in general is like, am I even saying, you know, why didn't you just grab Seamus right there? I get a little too like, all right, come on, but people aren't going to this movie for that. They're going for fucking car scenes and, you know, all that shit. So
they're going to see Robert De Niro. So
yep,
Robert De Niro make out with Natasha McElroy. I know.
Yeah, some of this movie. 54-year-old De Niro making out with like 30-year-old.
I'll give him a little bit of credit. He's way better than when Pacino does any make out scenes. So I will definitely give De Niro a little bit of credit there.
Although in this era, you know, let's say post-Heat, Pacino does give my favorite performance, Devil's Advocate, because it's fucking nuts.
I think old Bobby D, also, his running scenes are impressive at the Coliseum, too.
Good, yeah.
He can run. 54-year-old De Niro.
Good runner. Good runner. Yeah, I'll give him that.
Not bad.
I hope I'm still moving like that.
Yeah.
All right. So this is Wrap It Up, Ronan. We gave all of our ratings, and now it's on our guest, Warren. What is the next movie in this series that we are going to do?
All right, so we are going to go for 2014's The Guest.
Ooh, very nice. I'm quite the fan. That should be very fun.
Nice. Very nice.
I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, stay tuned for that. As I mentioned on the last podcast, this movie is available. Ronin's available on Amazon Prime for free right now if you're a subscriber to that. So fucking get on this, watch this, and listen to this fucking podcast. And stay tuned next time for The Guest. That's all I got. Do you guys have anything else?
That's it.
All righty.
I'm good.
See you. All right. Peace.
You've been listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network at BingeMedia.net. Support the show by donating on Patreon at Patreon.com/BingeMedia. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Buy some merch at BingeMedia.net/shop. Subscribe to our newsletter at BingeMedia.net/newsletter. And don't forget,
I didn't stop giving handjobs because I was good at it. I stopped giving handjobs because I was the best at it.